From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Investigators are digging deeper into Ahmad Khan Rahami's background, and they're focusing on his international travel. Rahami is the man arrested yesterday in connection with bombing attacks this weekend in New York City and New Jersey. NPR investigations correspondent Joseph Shapiro joins us now with more. Hi there, Joe.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, what are investigators saying about Rahami's travel specifically to Afghanistan and Pakistan?
So we know now that in just the last few years, Rahami, who was born in Afghanistan, was making frequent trips back and forth to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And these trips would last for months. He had a long stay in Quetta for about a year. That's in Pakistan on the border with Afghanistan. And the ruling council of the Afghan Taliban is based there. Al-Qaeda has a big presence there. We also know that he spent time in Karachi, and the Pakistan Taliban is active there. And I should point out that those are not places where ISIS is active, but the Afghan and Pakistan Taliban are, and Al-Qaeda.
Did he have contact with any of those groups?
You know, investigators, they don't know yet. There may be clues, though, in that pressure cooker that he left on the street in Manhattan, the bomb that didn't go off. My colleague Dina Temple-Raston, who is NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, she reported today that the pressure cooker bomb had a much more powerful explosive than the ones that went off at the Boston Marathon, and that it had a more sophisticated detonator. And so the sophistication of those bombs raises questions. Did he have training or even help in how to make them?
I see. So what do we know then about Rahami in the days before the bombing?
Well, our colleague Joel Rose, reporting from New Jersey, says he met a neighbor today, a woman who ate frequently at the family's restaurant. And she said that she saw Ahmad Khan Rahami often because he was working in the restaurant. But she said she noticed the change in him over just the last month and a half, that he seemed, in her word, disorientated, and she questioned his mental health.
Okay, so Rahami, of course, is in custody now. He was arrested yesterday. Is he talking to investigators?
You know, Dina Temple-Raston reported that he is not cooperating with investigators, but investigators have been speaking with his father and with his brothers. And in fact, his father spoke to reporters this morning outside that family restaurant, the First American Fried Chicken in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And there have also been reports today that, quote, anonymous senior law enforcement officials who say that 2 years ago, Ahmad Rahami's father told police his son was a terrorist, that this happened after there had been some tension in the family. In 2014, Rahami had been arrested in a stabbing, and there are reports that he stabbed his brother. And at the time, it's been reported that the father told local police, my son's a terrorist, and that this was passed on to the FBI. Now, today, the father told reporters his son is not a terrorist and that the FBI knows this.
Okay, so what more then do we know about his life in America?
You know, it had all the pull and tug of an immigrant trying to find his place in a new and different country. We know he was born in Afghanistan in 1988. He's an American citizen now. It's not clear when exactly the family came to the U.S., but his father, he'd been in New Jersey since at least 1989 or 1990. That's when we found records that his father got his Social Security card. But then the son graduated from high school in Edison, New Jersey in 2007. He attended Middlesex County College for 2 years. He studied criminal justice, but he didn't graduate. We know he liked, you know, some things about him. He liked cars. He played basketball. He worked in his family's restaurant.
Well, still many more unanswered questions, and we'll keep asking them. That's NPR's investigations correspondent, Joe Shapiro. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, of course, this issue has made it onto the campaign trail. And yesterday, Donald Trump used the news of the arrest of Ahmad Khan Rahami to push for tougher vetting of people coming into the country.
We want to make sure we are only admitting people into our country who love our country. We want them to love our country.
And today, President Obama is at the UN urging leaders to join the U.S. and other countries in accepting more refugees from war-torn Syria. Joining us from Miami is Alan Gomez, who covers immigration for USA Today. Alan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And at this point, do we know if increased vetting would have stopped this attack from happening in New York and the attempted attacks in New Jersey?
That is a fantastic question, and the answer depends on who you ask today. This has been something that's been going on now for a couple of years in the United States. Every time we see one of these domestic terror attacks or a big enough terror attack taking place overseas, the concern becomes, can that happen here? How do we stop that from happening again? And in so many cases, we've seen the natural inclination is to say, well, in some cases, stop all immigration or really increase that vetting of some of these immigrants. But when you start looking at these cases one by one, you start realizing that some of these solutions that they're proposing, short of just banning everybody, might not have worked.
Well, and in the case of Rahami, he came at a relatively young age. I wonder how much vetting you can do of somebody who is just a preteen or a very young teenager. And then secondly, he did go back to Pakistan and have to come back into the U.S. And I guess there will be a lot of questions now about how much vetting he got when he came back from Pakistan.
You're right. It's that travel that he was doing back and forth. Reports are that he was traveling to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and at one point might have traveled to some pretty hot spots in both of those countries. And that was something that was obviously checked and he was questioned about on his way back in. But clearly something fell apart there. We didn't catch what, if anything, he was doing over there that might have contributed to what we saw in New York this weekend. And so, yeah, I think we focused a lot on that initial screening in the last few years of people when they first get into this country, when they first get refugee status, when they get citizenship. But it's that follow-up travel to some of these places that I think we're going to start hearing a little bit more about in the next few
days.
Well,
and when somebody comes back from a place like Pakistan, do they sit for hours at the airport and wait as they're interrogated by immigration people, or is it really a random selection? How do the immigration officials decide how much to question somebody?
Well, as somebody who's traveled to places like that and has a very interesting looking passport, I can tell you absolutely you get pulled out and you get asked a lot of questions about what you were doing there. You know, it depends on a lot of factors. It depends on what comes up on your background, if you have any kind of criminal history, whether you seem believable, what sort of backup information you can provide. So it sort of depends on where you are going and what your profile is, what your background is.
There's been a lot of talk about tightening the border because of the security threat. Do we know at this point if any of the attacks or attempted attacks over the last several years have come from people who crossed the Mexican border rather than flew into the country?
When we look at cases that I think we refer to more traditionally as terrorism, some of these bigger cases that we've looked at, no, I've yet to see a case like that. We've been hearing about that threat for decades, about, you know, that terrorist that's going to come across the southwest border and blow something up in the United States. So instead, what I think they're calling for is more of a tightening at airports when people are getting in here and screening who's getting visas, who's getting green cards, and who's being allowed into the country through that legal process, which is what makes it such a much more difficult thing to approach.
And of course, then there are the cases of the terrorists who were born in this country. The Orlando shooter was, and so was the San Bernardino shooter.
Yeah, Omar Mateen from Orlando. He was born in New York to parents who had immigrated here from Afghanistan during that country's civil war in the 80s. In San Bernardino, Rizwan Farooq, he was born in Chicago to Pakistani parents. In his case, he brought over his accomplice in that case was his wife, who was born in Pakistan, raised in Saudi Arabia, and was brought into the country through a fiancé visa. They had gotten married, and that's how she got into the country. But even going back to Fort Hood, Nidal Hassan, he was born in Arlington, Virginia. It's interesting to see sort of what the focus becomes after these shootings. Like, I think it's important to kind of look at the Paris attacks. Right after that, there was a report that one of the bombers might have been a Syrian refugee. And that completely overtook the debate here in the United States about whether we needed to stop people coming from Syria. And it turned out none of them ended up being Syrian refugees. But that is enough to drive the kind of conversation that we're having now.
Speaking of Syrian refugees, I have to ask you before you go about a tweet that has gotten a lot of attention in the last 24 hours. It came from Donald Trump Jr., and it was about Skittles. It said, "If I had a bowl of Skittles and I told you three would kill you, would you take a handful? That's our Syrian refugee problem." Now, a lot of people very upset by that, and Skittles actually responded as well, saying, "Skittles are candy, refugees are people." Alan Gomez is somebody who covers immigration and vetting and all of that. Your thoughts on that?
What strikes me the most is the idea that we just got through a weekend where a naturalized U.S. citizen from Afghanistan is suspected of committing these bombings, and we're talking about Syrian refugees. And that's the part that's that disconnect that I don't get. Since 9/11, there's been something like 750,000 refugees admitted into the United States. Only a handful of those have even been charged with any kind of terrorism crimes, and those were from other countries. Not a single Syrian refugee that's been admitted to the United States has even faced any sort of terrorism charges. I can easily see how the tone of that tweet has upset many people, and just factually, it's not borne out in what we're seeing going on here in the United States.
Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And by the way, the guy who took the photo of the Skittles in that tweet, turns out he was a refugee from the Turkish occupation of Cyprus. He told the BBC the image was not used with his permission, and he would never approve the use of an image against refugees.
Low energy prices have cut deep into state budgets that rely on a healthy demand for oil and gas. And public universities in places like New Mexico, Louisiana, and Wyoming are feeling the squeeze. The University of Wyoming in Laramie is coping with a $41 million reduction in state funding over 2 years. And that means the school's new president, Lori Nichols, is in a tough spot. President Nichols joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, you have declared a financial crisis at the University of Wyoming. Describe how that crisis is having an impact on the school.
You know, I have to say that overall, I don't think it has had a huge impact on the startup of our fall semester. It looks like our enrollment is going to be maybe down a little. And by that, I'm talking maybe a 150 or so students. I think overall, we've done quite well this fall.
Nevertheless, I see that you've cut several hundred jobs already. Is that true?
Well, we have eliminated vacancies thus far, and we have also rolled out this past summer, we rolled out an early retirement incentive program. As you can imagine, a university's payroll is almost all people, and that is true here, too. About 80% of our budget is personnel.
I'm also seeing, though, that some professors may be required to teach more because of some of those vacancies are with faculty. Is that true?
One of the first things I asked was just simply to look at what the teaching load of the faculty were. And so as I started looking at that data, it became clear to me that if we asked faculty to teach, for example, one more course per year, we could decrease our budget in adjuncts and part-time hires to the tune of about $2.5 million by just simply using our regular permanently hired faculty a little bit more in the classroom.
Could that have an impact on the research that those same faculty members are capable of doing?
It can, and I've heard a lot about that, and that is the downside to it. But we have tried really hard to say that for those faculty that are very research active, that we will take a look. I mean, this is a case-by-case basis.
Beyond cuts, I mean, in going down the line in year 2, 3, 4, do you see any possibility or any other way to make up the $41 million loss?
I don't know that we'll make up all of it, but we're working very hard right now on a revenue enhancement plan. The in-state tuition here is just really, really low. I mean, it's so affordable to go to the University of Wyoming for in-state students. And of course, that's the beauty of Wyoming is the state has stepped up for many years and has funded public higher education so that it has stayed very affordable for the citizens of the state. And I'm not suggesting major jumps in tuition here at all, but I think we're going to have to look at modest increases as we move forward, especially for in-state.
You know, President Nichols, I've spoken with a lot of university presidents in my time, and I fully understand that a major part of the job is to be, rightfully, each individual institution's sort of best cheerleader, to say, here's why you should support us, here's why you should go here. But if you forgive me for saying this, am I incorrect in saying that maybe you want to say more about the major impact that the $41 million cut's going to have, but don't feel like you can? Because to me, it seems significant, and I'm not quite sure I'm hearing that same sense of concern right now from you.
Well, I'm very concerned. I mean, you know, I'm a new president here. I don't know if you know that, but I've only been here 4 months. we actually started by developing a set of principles, and we just said, these are the things we hold sacred, and we are going to try very hard not to impact these things.
And what are those things?
Well, the first is just being true to our mission. You know, we are the public four-year institution in Wyoming. We need to be true to our mission of teaching, research, and service as a land-grant university. And our second was is we have to hang on to very high-quality academic programs, and we have to make sure students can be successful. And I would just say one more thing. I have tried to be very clear as I go out across the states that these budget cuts will have an impact. You can't take this much money out of the budget and not have an impact. But we also want to be very good team players. I mean, all state agencies are going through a budget cut in Wyoming.
That, I think, is an extraordinarily important point, and it actually leads me to my final question to you. The entire state, and you know, at the beginning of the conversation, we mentioned other states, New Mexico, Louisiana, Alaska, whose state economies are very dependent on energy, the energy sector, are going through a tough time now. And I'm wondering, when you look long term, you've just started, as you point out, but when you look long term to the distant future for the University of Wyoming, do you feel like it's time to maybe encourage the state to diversify out of the energy sector a little bit more or embrace other fields that can soften the blow whenever we hit these periods of low energy prices?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I do believe that. You know, I think energy will always be a major part of the Wyoming economy, but I think Wyoming has to seriously look at diversification. And there's no question but what the University of Wyoming can and will play a very strong role in that conversation.
Well, Lori Nichols is the president of the University of Wyoming. Thank you so much for your time today. It's much appreciated.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's a similar story in Alaska, a state that gets 90% of its general fund from oil revenue. Alaska's budget is currently about $3 billion in the red. And at the University of Alaska system, that means a $52 million reduction this year alone. But President Jim Johnson says he's cutting even more deeply than that so that the state can shore up investments in its K-12 system. President Johnson joins us now. And Mr. Johnson, why are you making these additional cuts?
It's about the talent of our people. And we're on the front line with our colleagues in K-12 on creating that talent that will then create a knowledge economy, a more diversified economy for Alaska's future.
But what about those folks in the nearer term who are, you know, in the University of Alaska now? I mean, those additional deeper cuts certainly must have an impact on them.
Oh, they certainly do. We reduced over 500 positions from last year to this year. In addition to that, we are looking at our structure. You know, we have 3 universities and 13 community colleges in our system. Just a little geography lesson here. Our 16 campuses are across our entire state. If you were to transpose Alaska onto the lower 48 states, as we call you, we would have a campus in Charleston, South Carolina, a campus in Iowa, a campus in South Dakota, and a campus in Oklahoma. Half of our campuses are not accessible by land. And we're looking very hard right now at how we're actually organized. We have 3 schools of education. Do we need 3 or 2 enough? How about 1? Can we use technology to reduce that infrastructure?
But, you know, say you're talking to an Alaskan high school senior right now who would like to go to the University of Alaska but is thinking, with all these cuts, the programs that I want, the professors that I want, I may not be there. So could you inadvertently be driving those young people out of the state who then might end up staying outside of Alaska?
Well, the pledge I make to that student is somewhere in the University of Alaska, you will have access to what you want to study. It may not be in your village. It may not be in your town. But it's going to be here in Alaska someplace. Frankly, though, we've got a bigger challenge. We have a high school dropout rate in Alaska of 29%. And then the next 40% don't even go on to college. So 69% of our average ninth graders out there in Alaska are not going to graduate from high school and not going to go on to college. So, yes, I'm certainly concerned about a brain drain of our smart young people leaving Alaska for college. I'm frankly more concerned about Alaskans who are deciding not to go on to college at all.
With those fundamentals, do you consider part of your job now to advocate to the state government that it's time for Alaska to diversify the areas in which it gets revenue for its general fund? I mean, being 90% dependent on oil, when the times are great, it's great for the state, right? But, you know, in times of low energy prices like now, it's awful to be that beholden to one sector. It certainly can't be good for Alaska or the laser-like focus that you have on education as a whole in the long run.
To emphasize your point even more, we rely on our state government more than any other state university system does for funding. At the same time, we advocate generally on behalf of a more diversified financial picture for our state.
Do you mean that it's time for Alaska to introduce a sales tax or an income tax? Two things it currently does not have.
I was not elected by the people of Alaska to make those kinds of decisions. I advocate for diversification, for stability, for consistency over time, for certainty. It is the number one issue, political issue in Alaska today, and I'm confident that in the coming legislative session, it'll be priority one of the governor and of the legislature in trying to resolve their very significant differences on this issue.
I keep thinking of that $52 million cut that you're facing this year. If these low oil prices persist for several more years, what could two, three, four more years of these kind of cuts do to the university system as a whole?
I can't see us simply shrinking down and shrinking and shrinking. And, I mean, that'll just reinforce the outflight of those who want to go to college and the decision not to go to college at all. During those years of big oil money, the University of Alaska system grew to offer 478 degree and certificate programs. We have brought it down to 445, and frankly, reviewing another 75 of those this year so that we can ensure that young person you asked about a minute ago, we can ensure that person somewhere in Alaska you can study this, and hopefully it'll even be in a stronger program because we've invested in one strong program as opposed to three.
Well, Jim Johnson is the president of the University of Alaska System. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
On Capitol Hill today, Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf apologized for the millions of fake accounts that were opened by his employees in recent years.
I am deeply sorry that we failed to fulfill on our responsibility to our customers, to our team members, and to the American public.
Stumpf also said that no one at the bank directed team members to create the fake accounts. The bank was fined $185 million by regulators earlier this month. Mike Regan is columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He's watching the hearings on Capitol Hill. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And by the way, I apologize for using the term team members instead of just saying employees. That's their speak, not ours. But first of all, just remind us what happened with these fake accounts.
Well, basically, Wells Fargo has long encouraged employees to do what's called cross-selling, which is if you have a customer in one business line in the bank, say a savings account or a credit card, then you're encouraged to try to sell them on other products. And it's coming out that the pressure was great on the employees to do this, and that people that weren't quite meeting the sales targets would resort to creating these bogus accounts in order to either keep their job or get the pressure off of them, or else to get, you know, qualify for a bonus because of these sales targets they were
facing. And did
we
find out anything today about when Stumpf found out about this and whether he told regulators?
He was a little bit fuzzy on the exact timeline. He said it was brought to the quote-unquote corporate level where he found out about it in 2013. But the retail unit was dealing with it much earlier than that. And in fact, Senator Bob Menendez read an email from a Wells Fargo employee who was basically complaining about problems with cross-selling directly to Mr. Stumpf in 2011.
Let's listen to one of the exchanges from today. This is from Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, and she's talking here to John Stumpf about what he has and hasn't done to show accountability.
Have you returned one nickel of the millions of dollars that you were paid while this scam was going on?
The board will take care
of that. Have you returned one nickel of the money you earned while this scam was going on.
And the board will do...
I will take that as a no, then. Have you fired a single senior executive? And by that, I don't mean a regional manager or branch manager. I'm asking about the people who actually led your community banking division or your compliance division.
We've made a change in our regional to lead our regional bank.
I just said I'm not asking about regional managers. I'm asking if you have fired senior management.
Carrie Toll said.
Did you fire
no.
any of those people? No.
So interesting exchange there, Mike. And we heard Stumpf mention Carrie there. That's Carrie Tolstead, who led the division where the bank accounts were created. She decided to retire this year, although she's getting more than $100 million in stocks and options. What did Stumpf say about her?
Well, the big question is whether or not the bank will, what they call, claw back some of that money she's been paid. And he was asked this question several times in different forms. And much like the question over his own pay, he sort of dodged it, saying it was up to the compensation committee of the board of directors. And he says he's not a member of that. They're an independent committee, and he doesn't want to influence their decision by making a recommendation.
All right. We'll keep watching the hearings as they continue on Capitol Hill. Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
The U.S. produces more than 250 million tons of waste every year. About 65% of that is trash, which means it's headed for the landfill or the incinerator. And that number could go up, especially when you consider that more people are shopping online, which means more packaging and more waste. Houston-based Waste Management is the largest disposal company in the U.S. It also does recycling. And as part of our series View from the Top, where we speak with leaders, we're joined now by the president of Waste Management, Jim Fish. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, how much waste is your company dealing with right now?
We are dealing with about 100 million tons a year, just slightly less than that, about 96 million tons to be exact.
And are you seeing an increase over recent years because of all the online shopping and stuff that's going on?
You know, it's interesting. It's really just a change of channel for us. If you think about waste being sold through a big box store and now going through kind of an Amazon Prime, it really just kind of changes where we see it. We used to see it on the commercial side of our business, and now we see it on the residential side.
And how much of it is recycling?
That's hard to say. I would tell you that overall, about 35% of our overall waste is recycled. It had been going up for many years. It's plateaued a bit. So The last 2 years, we've seen it plateau. And don't know whether that is just kind of a temporary plateau or whether it's plateaued permanently.
And I've seen that in recent years, it has become less economically viable for companies to recycle because the cost of the materials has changed. What's going on with that right now? Does it make sense financially for you to be recycling certain materials?
Absolutely makes sense for us to recycle. But we have had to change the model a little bit because, as you said, commodity prices have been on a kind of a consistent downward trend over the last 4 to 5 years. Used to be that commodity prices for us that we sold out of our recycle plants averaged about $100, and it cost us about $60 to process, and then we would kind of split the difference with the customer. And we've seen both our cost go up because China, which is a big consumer, has imposed some quality controls on us, and then we've seen the price that we can sell those commodities at on the back end come down. So we've changed our pricing model a bit, but it is still economically viable for us for sure.
Well, and when you say China is a big consumer, explain that, because I think a lot of people, you know, they put their recycling out on the street, it goes away, and they don't know what happens to it after that. But in fact, a lot of it gets sold to China, right?
Correct. When you think about recycled newsprint, for example, almost all of that ends up in China. Cardboard, not all of it, but certainly a material amount of it ends up in China. They produce a lot that we buy, but they need a lot of cardboard to box it up, and so they are a big consumer of recycled cardboard.
We saw a recent profile of Waste Management in Forbes that said that you guys recently slashed money-losing green initiatives, sold a high-tech incinerator business for $2 billion, and mothballed 22 of 126 recycling plants. Is that something that's going on? Are you getting rid of your recycling assets because of profitability problems?
Well, no, and you've talked about a couple of different lines of business there. So specifically, with our waste energy business, we felt like it added a lot of volatility to our business model, and so we felt that it was somewhat of a no growth or slow growth business in the United States. So it made sense for us to divest of it. Recycling, we've had several closures of recycle plants, but in total, we still are the biggest recycler in North America. And so those plants that have closed have really been a function of, obsolescence or just simply moving them because of low profitability. And those are few and far between.
As you look from your vantage point, you've got a unique vantage point because you see what we do with all of our waste and all of our recycling. What do you think that the government could be doing to make wise decisions about the waste that we produce in this country, something beyond what you could do? But as you look at it, do you say, if only Americans did this, they'd be better off?
You know, I think and by the way, we typically deal with state and local government. And I think what they could do to kind of intervene here is, as opposed to talking about diversion, which is basically moving trash away from landfills, they could talk about true recycling. And the difference between the two is you may divert tons away, first step away from a landfill, but it ultimately ends up back in the landfill if it was kind of trash to begin with.
Hmm.
At our recycle plants, we've seen our trash coming out of the back end of those plants go from about 10% to 20%, yet the tons count as diverted tons to a municipality, and we'd prefer to think about it as recycling because recycling is what's better for the environment.
We're speaking with Jim Fish, who is the president of Waste Management. And Jim Fish, I want to ask you about garbage trucks because they get about, on average, 3 miles per gallon of gasoline, but we've seen an increase in the number of fleets using natural gas. How much of a change has Waste Management made on this front?
Well, we've made significant progress in moving from diesel to natural gas. And natural gas, as you know, is cleaner burning and more efficient for us. But it also has some ancillary benefits. It's quieter. Our customers like the trucks better. It's the trucks are actually lighter because they don't have as much emission equipment on them. And we've fairly quickly ramped up from zero, literally, to about 20% of our fleet and continue to buy the majority of our trucks each year as natural gas versus diesel.
Any thought of moving to fully electric, or does that work right now with the technology that exists for a garbage truck?
Well, we've looked at it and we'll continue to look at it. It's our trucks are big trucks and require a lot of horsepower. And, mm-hmm. and so we have tested out a hybrid. We'd love to test out electric. I know GE has some electric locomotives. So, you would think that power isn't an issue, and I think we will continue to look at those types of technologies. We've even considered down the road things like autonomous trucks, which I think is still years away. But
well, maybe not that far away. We've already got these self-driving Ubers going around in Pittsburgh right now. So
that's right.
And people may be surprised to hear that being a garbage collector is actually, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, more dangerous than being a police officer. 33 fatalities per 100,000 workers. And often what happens is that some impatient driver will try to go around the truck when it's stopped on the street and hit one of the collectors. So what do you have to do to ensure the safety of the garbage collectors?
Boy, we spend – in fact, I was just on a conference call before I came over talking about that exact topic. We spend a lot of time focused on safety. You're right. It is an industry that where we're exposed because our drivers are and our helpers are out on the road, particularly those helpers who are outside of the vehicle. So we spend a lot of time, effort, money on making sure that our employees are as safe as they can possibly be. We've put cameras, for example, in our trucks that can see what they do is on a continuous loop, show us kind of the 10 seconds before an event and the 10 seconds after that event.
Hmm.
And if we can see where we have a coaching opportunity. So we really spend a lot of time and effort on safety of our employees.
And what about compensation for them? What are your thoughts, for example, on raising the minimum wage?
You know, our employees are priced above the minimum wage, so we really haven't been affected by that. I mean, I guess I have a personal view on it, but from a company standpoint, We feel like we price or pay our employees a fair wage. We have about 20% of our employees that are unionized employees, and they negotiate their own contracts, and then the rest are on an agreement with the company individually, just like I am.
So, Jim Fish, in 10 years, where do you see waste management?
I think you're going to see you're going to see some technology really be brought to bear with waste management. I mentioned the potential for autonomy with vehicles, but things like augmented reality to help us on the maintenance side, and a lot of it will help us with things like the impending driver and technician shortage. There are about 50,000 openings within not just our business but across the entire transportation industry for drivers. We've got to figure out a way to address that.
That's Jim Fish, the president of Waste Management. Jim Fish, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
At a press conference Monday, Tulsa, Oklahoma Police Chief Chuck Jordan called the video of the police shooting of Terrence Crutcher very disturbing and difficult to watch. Crutcher is African-American and was unarmed when he was killed on Friday. Wesley Lowry is a national reporter for The Washington Post. Wesley, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, can you describe to us what we know happened in the lead up to the shooting in Tulsa?
Of course, and it still remains a little unclear. What we do know is that Terrence Crutcher, 40-year-old black man in Tulsa, had a car that stopped in the middle of a road, at which point he encountered an officer who was responding to a separate incident. She pulled up on him. They had some type of exchange of words. And then the video cuts in. And then what we see is the officer with her weapon drawn and Terrence Crutcher with his hands up walking back towards his vehicle. Moments later, as we see in the video, as several other officers also respond to this incident, Crutcher falls to the ground, seemingly having been shot.
Hmm. And he had also been tased as well?
Yeah, and so there's a little confusion here on the exact sequence of events. We know that the two officers who deployed force, one officer fired his taser, and another officer fired her weapon. And so it's unclear if that happened at the same time, if it was one before the other. But we know in a short sequence of events that he both was hit with a taser as with lethal force.
Hmm. Now, after this video was released yesterday, you put out a tweet where you said that beyond details of the encounter, Terrence Crutcher's latest example is of officers watching as someone they've shot bleeds out. Now, it seems like in the video, several minutes go by before officers...
Yeah, so it appears that it's at least a minute and a half, perhaps 2 minutes, before officers begin any type of physical examination of Terrence Crutcher. So again, he's been shot. He's now lying in the road, bleeding onto the ground. And the officers kind of methodically move themselves back away from his body, circle the car, and then finally someone approaches him. Now, this is not dissimilar from what we've seen in several other high-profile shootings, whether it be the Tamir Rice case where the 12-year-old boy lay on the ground after being shot by officers for several minutes before another responding officer provided him medical care, the Eric Gardner case where we hear him saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and then ends up laying lifeless on the ground while they wait for paramedics to get there. And very recently, the Paul O'Neill case in Chicago, which was earlier this summer, in which officers were walking around comforting each other as the man they had just shot lie on the ground. I've talked to a lot of police chiefs about this, and that raises a crucial question, right? That even beyond the shooting itself, even if you believe the shooting to be justified, and I think in many people would argue that all of those cases were not. Others would think that they are. It raises a secondary question about what is the obligation and also what is the training? What are we telling officers they should do in the moments after someone is shot and killed? Because we know in some of these cases, perhaps with more prompt medical attention, some of these people might still be alive.
Hmm. What kind of response has been coming from the community?
You know, you have to remember that Tulsa is a community that's had several such incidents. So if we remember the Eric Harris shooting, which occurred last year, it was in a flurry of shootings where we saw unarmed black men being shot by officers. He happened right around the Walter Scott shooting as well as the Sam DuBose shooting. That was Tulsa County Sheriff's deputies. You also have, if you remember, the Daniel Holzclaw case, which was a case of an officer being convicted of sexually assaulting several women. That was not far away. And so here is a community that is very hurt and pained by what they've seen in this video, especially the black community. The pain that we've heard and we've seen in many cities around the country after these. You know, it's very easy sometimes to say, well, that's a Ferguson problem, or that's a Baltimore problem, or that's a New York problem. And I don't live in Ferguson. I don't live in Baltimore. I don't live in New York. It's much different when something like this happens in your backyard, right, in your city, on your side street that you take home from work.
So I want to be careful in how I say this, because I mean no disrespect to anybody who's involved with what happened in Tulsa. But is one of the remarkable things about what happened in Tulsa the fact that it seems unremarkable now, because it's the same pattern of events and reactions that we've seen in so many shootings in the past couple of years?
You know, I think that those of us who've followed these issues very closely, it feels like deja vu. It's another name. It's trending on Twitter. It's another video being released. It's another police chief or mayor stepping to a microphone and urging peace and asking for, you know, peaceful protest and vowing that there will be justice and transparency. You know, what we know is that, you know, police in the United States of America shoot and kill three people every single day. The majority of those people are armed. The majority of those people are attacking the police officers. But what we know is that it's only a matter of time until we find the next video of an unarmed black man being shot and killed, or the next incident of a child being killed. And so while we've been having this conversation now in earnest for 2.5 years since Ferguson, Missouri, and Michael Brown, we have not seen large-scale change in how we police this nation. And we can only expect this to continue.
Well, Wesley Lowery is a national reporter for The Washington Post. He's author of the forthcoming book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wesley, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.